and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is Sir William Flinders Petrie, and this is the second and final part in the presentation. As always, I have with me my co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Shall we talk about more enlightened times and talk about our Greatest Britons for this week, Max, do you think?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, let's talk about our Greatest Briton for this week, Sir William Flinders Petrie, and we'll start with a recap. In the last episode, we talked about Petrie's time in Palestine and his work in Amarna, the city of Akhenaten, the heretic pharaoh, where his dig actually became a tourist attraction and the local Arabs trashed some of the artwork he had discovered in order to prevent the people from tramping all over their fields. He was the first to discover mention of the Israelites in Egypt, and this was on the reverse side of a huge stele commemorating the pharaoh Meneptah smiting the Libyans, the Israelites, and the peoples of the sea. We also heard about his close relationship with Sir Francis Galton and Carl Pearson, and how Galton funded one of his expeditions in order to collect racial types in the form of heads. Petrie went on to systematise the classification of people into races by head measurements and was able to predict whether they had the ability to build a civilization or not simply from their head size. These criteria were further confirmed with the advent of IQ testing, which showed that those with the largest brains had the highest intelligence. And we mainly talked about the racial aspects last week, more so than the archaeological aspects. But do you want to add anything to that recap, Max?
Just to say that Flinders Petrie, just like Francis Galton and Carl Pearson and Charles Darwin, for that matter, were a class of people that existed in Britain during the 19th century, who were polymaths and who had the capacity to study a very wide range of fields, and so therefore had might appear to ordinary people as being a sort of an all-encompassing view of the way things are and the possibilities and the potential for the future if we organize ourselves properly. And so my view is that there still will be people of their caliber within our society, but people who are not paid the same sort of attention that they were in their day, but hopefully things might change and we might have an entirely different approach to such people and the ideas that they share in the future.
Yeah, it's almost like they had superhuman intelligence, and they were honoured for that as well. They were the celebrities of their day. People travelled out there to Egypt to have a look at this dig. I mean, that's why these Arabs got upset that their fields were being trampled on. I mean, not like archaeologists today that people probably couldn't even name. These were famous people that were asked for their opinion on things. They were the equivalent of the movie stars and the pop stars that we have today. Only they were being honoured for these great achievements that they've made and the discoveries that they made for Great Britain. Well, in 1923, Petrie was knighted for services to British archaeology and Egyptology. The focus of his work shifted permanently to Palestine in 1926. From 1927 until 1938, he excavated Palestine under the auspices of the American School of Research. And while he was there, he discovered the ruins of 10 cities in Tel el-Hisi. He began excavating several important sites in the southwest of Palestine, including Tel Jemma and Tel el-Adjul. In parallel with his work in Palestine, Petrie became interested in early Egypt, and in 1928, while digging a cemetery at Luxor, this proved to be so huge that he devised an entirely new excavation system, including comparison charts for finds, which is still used today. I mean, he really set the standards for archaeology. He wrote a book on it, which is still in use today, and all these systems that he worked out are the systems that are used today. In 1933, on retiring from his professorship, he moved permanently to Jerusalem, where he lived with Lady Petrie at the British School of Archaeology, then temporarily headquartered at the American School of Oriental Research, which is today called the W.F. Albright Institute of Archaeological Research. So they've given it, they've named it for a Jewish person now. And of course, now that there is a Jewish administration in Palestine and you have the country of Israel, they don't allow any of this digging, any of this archaeology, because it's against the Jewish religion to disturb the remains of Jews. Of course, that's the same reason why they're not allowed to dig around in the work camps either. You got any thoughts on that, Max?
No, other than just really to endorse your sort of interpretation of what's going on there. And you know, I particularly like what you said about these people being the superstars of their day, and being as well known as rock stars or people of that sort are today, but being known for their knowledge and also the understanding that they brought of the natural world that people hitherto hadn't yet realized.
Superstars that actually deserved the honours that were paid to them, and also set a very good example for everyone else to follow. Well, Petri died in Jerusalem on the 28th of July 1942, and his body was interred in the Protestant cemetery on Mount Zion. But he donated his head, and thus his brain, to the Royal College of Surgeons of London. World War II was then at its height, and the head was delayed in transit. After being stored in a jar in the college basement, its label fell off, and no one knew to whom the head belonged. However, it was eventually identified and is now stored, but not displayed, at the Royal College of Surgeons. And we'll talk about this a little bit more later on, but I mean, it does seem rather macabre to have his head chopped off and display it. But this was quite a common thing at the time. If you think that they were really interested in brain size and how that and how that related to whether people were able to build a civilization or not, that tied into it. And also because people were saying, well, isn't it a little bit wrong of you to be digging up these bodies? And he was like, well, I'm quite happy to have my body being donated to science. I'm quite happy to have my body looked at after I've died. So it's not like what I'm doing to these ancient mummies is any different to what I would want to be done to myself. I would want people to be able to learn from me and from my body in the future. So this is the reason why he gave his head to the Royal College of Surgeons. And there are quite a few interesting legends that have sprung up around this as well, because basically its label fell off, that we'll get into a little bit later on. You got any thoughts on him donating his head to science, Max?
Well, there was a paper released quite recently which dealt with the evolution of early man, and it talks about how the vast majority of the interbreeding between early modern humans and Neanderthals took place in the Near East, in the sort of area of Israel and Amman and Lebanon, etc. Archaeologist, I can't remember the name of the archaeologist or where I read this now, just on the spur of the moment, but the point is the archaeologist, who was a lady, was mentioning there about how they're able to interpret the morphology, the sort of facial structure and the shape of the bones that form the face of a very large number of skulls from both sort of Neanderthal graves, but also from early modern graves, and also from modern humans that live throughout not just the Middle East, but also Europe and South Asia, and going north eastwards into Siberia and China. They've analysed the faces of these people, and what this archaeologist was saying is that you can determine the line of inheritance and the degree of inheritance of Neanderthal DNA by just examining the morphology of these skulls. Now, the morphology of Flinders Petrie's skull would obviously be an anatomically modern European person. But by the same token, if you find skulls, then you are able to define them by their facial morphology and determine what race the person was whose skull that was, and so you know, if you can determine whether the person was of a from one of the tribes of San people in South Africa. You can determine whether they are a Negro from the central parts of Africa. You can determine whether they are Hamitic or Nilotic from the northern parts of Africa. You can determine where they come from in Europe. You can determine whether they came from Southeast Asia. You can tell whether they are from China, etc. And so that there is a massive amount that can be interpreted from the shape of somebody's skull. And I would imagine that Flinders Petrus' skull would be a very interesting skull to examine.
Yeah, because we have to bear in mind this is before the discovery of DNA, when we can look at DNA and see what someone's inheritance was. So they would look at a skull and look at the measurements. And as you're pointing out there, Max, they'd be able to work out what the inheritance was. And something else that strikes me is, you know, you compare what these men look like. I mean, they're all very handsome, and you compare them to the sort of people that we have leading the government today that are supposed to be very, very intelligent. And of course, they're incredibly ugly. So it does seem as if being a polymath and being highly intelligent correlates with having good genes, being symmetrical, being handsome, and it's all tied together with high intelligence as well. Well, Petrie himself married Hilda Erlin in London on 26th of November 1896, and the couple had two children, John and Anne, and the family originally lived in Hampstead, London, where an English Heritage blue plaque has been placed on the building where they lived at 5 Cannon Place. John Flinders Petrie, that's his son, he became a noted mathematician who gave his name to the Petrie polygon. And if you remember at the start of this, we talked about how Petrie's wife's father was a famous explorer. He gave his name, I think, to somewhere in Australia. And their son gave his name to the Petrie polygon. So you can see that the intelligence is passed down through the family. Getting into his legacy here, Flinders Petrie's painstaking recording and study of artifacts set new standards in archaeology. He wrote, "I believe the true line of research lies in the noting and the comparison of the smallest details." And up to that point, it had all been about finding the largest finds and the biggest statues, but he was interested in looking at small things and looking at the pottery. By linking the styles of pottery with the periods, he was the first to use seriation in Egyptology, a new method for establishing the chronology of a site. So he standardized that as well, so that people could tell exactly what period it was that they were looking at when they were digging. Petrie was also responsible for mentoring and training a whole generation of Egyptologists, including Howard Carter, who went on to discover Tutankhamun's tomb. And on the centennial of Petrie's birth in 1953, his widow, Hilda Petrie, created a student travel scholarship to Egypt. So the most famous find ever in Egypt was carried out by one of Petrie's students, conforming to Petrie's instructions. Many thousands of artifacts were recovered during excavations led by Petrie, and they can be found in museums worldwide. A medal was struck in celebration of his 70th birthday, the Petrie Medal, when funds were raised to commission and produce 20 medals to be awarded once every 3 years for distinguished work in archaeology, preferably to a British subject. So we can see there that there is this loyalty to his ethnicity. The first medal was awarded to Petrie himself, 1925. And the first few recipients included Sir Aurel Stein, 1928, Sir Arthur Evans, 1931, Abbe Henry Breuil, 1934, Professor J.D. Beasley, 1937, Sir Mortimer Wheeler, 1950, Professor J.B. Wace, 1953, and Sir Leonard Woolley, 1957, another archaeologist that I find quite fascinating. He's the chap that discovered Ur of the Chaldees. He was very famous for the digs that he did in Mesopotamia. The BBC. Yeah, do you want to comment on any of that, Max?
No. I was just interested that you had heard of Leonard Woolley before and were impressed with the work that he's done.
Yeah, he was the first to discover what looks to be the origins of the biblical flood. I mean, he dug down and discovered that there was this oily layer, which was just everything was crushed, and there was remains of sea fossils in it, and then underneath it was another layer of civilization, and this layer actually stretched for hundreds of miles at the same level. So it was basically a localized flood that took place in Mesopotamia. And after that, you get the rise of Ur of the Chaldees, and you get the Bronze Age that begins. And before this flood, there was nothing. So it does look as if that was the origin of the flood. That's where I know him from. And the first discoveries of Sumerian civilization and all that sort of thing, which I'm fascinated by. So he was given the award in 1957. And as I was collecting the notes for this, I discovered that the BBC had actually done a documentary on him, or created a documentary on him. It's called The Man Who Discovered Egypt. And the blurb says, documentary about English Egyptologist Flinders Petrie. Ancient Egypt was vandalized by tomb raiders until one Victorian maverick pioneered modern field archaeology. So that's quite good. They actually credit him there with saving ancient Egypt. It was being vandalized by tomb raiders, vandalized by Arabs, basically, until this one Victorian Englishman went there and saved it. Now, unfortunately, the documentary is no longer available. And then I found this piece about the head, and this is from an article written about it. In a recent article for the journal Interdisciplinary Science Reviews, Sarah Perry and I explored the myths around the fact that the head of archaeologist William Matthew Flinders Petrie is a specimen in the collections of the Royal College of Surgeons. We tried to understand the context in which Petrie donated his head to science, his eugenic ideas, his focus on the face, his pedagogical collecting and curation practices, and along the way confronted many of the legends that have grown up around Petrie's head. One of the most famous, that Hilda Petrie brought back her husband's head in a hat box from Jerusalem after World War II, was repeated in the recent BBC4 television documentary, The Man Who Discovered Egypt. In fact, letters in the Petrie Museum archive illustrate that this romantic legend is just not true. Romantic, arguably, as it has some parallels with wives such as Mary Shelley retaining their beloved ones' body parts. Second only to the legends about how it got to England are the stories about who has seen Petrie's head, many of which are true, some of which we chronicled in the article. Petrie's head became a talking point for archaeologists in the know until the publication of Margaret Drower's 1985 biography, which explicitly states where Petrie's head is. I have not seen Petrie's head and have no desire to do so while it is locked away in its current state, fully fleshed, in a cupboard. Personally, I feel that to gain access just for the sake of seeing the head and saying that I have seen it would be merely titillating and serve no real educational or research purpose for myself or anyone else. So it seems as if this head has sort of achieved some mythical proportions, and it seems people, you know, are actually wanting to see his head. Today, archaeologists are still wanting to actually see the head. It's almost like it has some kind of religious significance. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, after we had the podcast last week, I did actually search on the internet to see what I could find out about this, and there are some photographs of a head in a specimen jar, which would superficially appear to be Flinders Petrie's head, because it's got those, you know, hair of the right sort of description. Although it is, the hair is very dark, and I imagine that either he must have dyed his hair when he was older, or he was remarkably well preserved at the point of his death. But beyond that, what I would say, though, is that there is much to be learned. And I would think that if the skulls of the other polymaths that we've mentioned, people like Charles Darwin and Francis Galton, etc., if their heads still exist, or their skulls still remain intact, it probably would make an interesting project to examine those skulls and see whether there are any significant features to them which could explain the reason for the high intelligence of those people.
It makes common sense, doesn't it, that, you know, if you've got an intelligent person, they're going to have a large head or a large brain, and there might be something different in there. And again, when all this was done, it was before we'd actually came out with IQ tests. So by looking at somebody's face and looking at the proportions and the symmetry and looking at the size of the head, you could guess whether they were going to be a highly intelligent person or not. Well, Petrie remains controversial for his anti-democratic and pro-eugenics racial views, being a dedicated believer in the superiority of the northern peoples over the Latinate and southern peoples. These views spilled over into his academic opinions. Believing that society is the product of racial biology, he contended that the culture of ancient Egypt was derived from an invading Caucasoid dynastic race, which had entered Egypt from the south in late pre-dynastic times, conquered the inferior, exhausted mulatto natives, and slowly introduced the higher dynastic civilization as it interbred with them. Petrie engaged in fierce controversies with the British Museum's Egyptology expert E.A. Wallace Budge, who contended that the religion of the Egyptians was not introduced by invaders, but was essentially identical to that of the people of northeastern and central Africa. However, most of their colleagues judged Petrie's opinion to be more scientific. And the first that I came across Egyptology was through a book by E.A. Wallace Budge, which was on the Book of the Dead. And I can remember in that he was sort of trying to tie in the Egyptian religion with the African religion. And of course, the Egyptian religion, all the gods are white. You can tell that from their proportions in the representations that are actually done of them. I mean, they may be different colours, but the proportions show that they are Caucasian. So why it would be Sub-Saharan Negroes that would have come up with this religion is beyond me. And I think Petrie was the one that was correct and not Budge. And his idea that but Petrie's idea that they actually came up from the south, I think that's probably not correct. I think they came in from the north. I think civilization began in Mesopotamia, and then I think it spread down into Egypt. I think at the same time in Egypt and Mesopotamia, and also in India, and also in Asia Minor, you had the same essential civilization or different civilizations that were in contact with one another, that were trading with one another. So I don't see how the white people came in from the south, but I do think he was correct. In fact, we know he was correct, that it was originally a white civilization, and we know that as they interbred with the Aborigines, the civilization fell and it had to be revived by white invaders two or three times, at first by Alexander the Great, then by the Romans, and even before Alexander the Great there was a revival, because there was a short period when, what's the name, the Nubians, there was a short period for about 100 years, I think, when the Nubians were actually ruling. The Nubians managed to overrule them, and we can see that the black Africans were treated as slaves, because there were signs that were put up saying that if any black African, any Nubian, is seen crossing this border, they will be executed. And we can also see from Tutankhamun's sandals, which has a picture of a Syrian on one side, which looks very similar to a modern Jew, and also a picture of a black African on the other sole. So he's actually walking on the soles of his feet. He's walking on his enemies. And there are other images of his enemies that were actually found in Tutankhamun's tomb, which confirm this. So they knew about race. They knew that their caste was a particular different race to the caste that they were ruling over. But at various times, they interbred with them. And that's the period, those are the periods when Egypt collapsed and fell, the civilization actually fell. Any comments on that, Max?
Oh, just it's long been believed that the civilizations that existed in the Middle East and in North Africa, as you say, were derived from a warrior caste that conquered those areas and then provided the inspiration for that civilization. And the main difference between what existed in the Middle East and North Africa and other places, the difference between those and the rest of Europe and Eurasia, basically, is that the peoples of Europe who provided the warrior caste that created the greater civilizations were people who were absolutely opposed to slavery and entering into slavery, and so preferred to fight to the death rather than allow themselves to be enslaved. This is one of the the common threads that runs through all freedom loving peoples, basically. But the point is that only when the warrior castes ventured down into Africa and ventured into Asia did they find people who they could conquer and who were prepared to allow themselves to be enslaved. And so as a result of the enslavement of those people, they then provided the cheap labor that was necessary in order for the massive monumental works to be undertaken, the creation of temples, the creation of large buildings with all the stone colonnades and all this sort of thing. Those type of ornamentations to the civilization were only possible in those days where the ruling elite of a society had a class of people that were prepared to be subjected and prepared to be enslaved in order to produce it. As far as the rest of Europe is concerned, similar ideas, similar notions would have existed amongst the peoples of Europe existed within the minds of those that had gone to far distant places and created those civilizations. But because the peoples of Europe steadfastly resisted their own enslavement, and as I said, were prepared to fight to the death rather than be enslaved, the expression of the civilization that existed in Europe was less dramatic and less awesome compared with the expression of the civilization as it was in North Africa and the Middle East.
Yes, that's a really important point that you raised there. They didn't have industrial machinery. What they did have is lots of slaves, and it was lots of slaves that did the heavy lifting to build the pyramids and these structures. They were designed by white people, and then they used the human resources that they found there in order to build them. Whereas in Europe, they couldn't do that. And although we did all club together to raise these giant cathedrals, but obviously that was 2,000 years later than this great civilization that was built in Egypt. Getting back to Flinders Petrie here, his involvement in Palestinian archaeology was examined in the exhibition A Future for the Past, Petrie's Palestinian Collection, because we mustn't forget his contribution to Palestinian archaeology as well as his contribution to Egypt. And a number of Petrie's discoveries were presented to the Royal Archaeological Society and described in the Society's Archaeological Journal by his good friend and fellow archaeologist Flaxman Charles John Spurrell. And Petrie published a total of 97 books, and he made contributions to the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, the old version of the internet. So I mean, he is quite an incredible figure to have in our greatest Britons. Absolutely fascinating character, a great contribution to just knowledge all around, particularly in Egypt, particularly for preventing Egypt from being lost to us, and for all these archaeological sites that he discovered and the information that he was able to actually glean from them. I mean, if it wasn't for him, archaeology would there probably wouldn't be any archaeology today. It would have all been destroyed by treasure hunters. Max, you got any final thoughts on Flinders Petrie here?
No, I don't think so. Other than that, the existence of his head, I find a continuing fascinating thing. And I think that it would be a shame if his head is stuck in that glass jar for the rest of eternity and nobody ever looks at it. And I would like to think that at some point in the future, that there would be an anatomist stroke archaeologist who would have the courage to examine Flinders Petrie's head and compare it with the heads of other notable people, because the skull, I think, of Beethoven has been preserved. I think that from recollection, I think that Charles Darwin donated his body to science as well, and that his brain exists somewhere. I think that there are the brains of various people that are preserved in jars, and it would be very interesting for somebody to undertake the project of analysing the heads of these people with an open mind, and not just to sort of parrot the usual woke nonsense about, you know, a large brain doesn't necessarily infer high intelligence, and to see whether there is something in the series that Flinders Petrie expressed. And as I say, it would be nice to think that somebody at some point in the future would have the courage to do that and report back objectively on what they find.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Reporting back objectively. I think all his theories have been found to be true, particularly with IQ testing. But of course, it all gets thrown out now as racist science or eugenics, despite the fact that it's all been found to be true. And recently, Nature came out with a new ethics guide saying that any scientific research that could be used to stigmatize a particular group, so basically any scientific research that shows that there is any difference between groups, should not be reported on. They should just not actually talk about it and not report on the results of it, which is absolutely scandalous. I mean, I think he was a fantastic man. I'm a big admirer of him. I'd like to read more of his books, and I'm fascinated by so many of these archaeologists. I mean, maybe it goes back to enjoying Raiders of the Lost Ark when I was a child, because that was based on a lot of these old British archaeologists who were seen as heroes to the nation. As we pointed out earlier, they were the celebrities, they were the pop stars of their day, and deservedly so. Thank you very much for listening, and do watch out in the future for more presentations from our series on our greatest Britons that you will find here at radioalbion.com.